Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ban Bhaiyo, Beno aur Buzruko, how's it? Hey? This is A.B. Dawji and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al-Ansar. Right. So, Habibi, how was your week, eh? Wonderfully exciting, stress-free, full of fun and laughter, and all that came crashing down with load shedding. Changed your mood completely, didn't it? Like those who came to the SAA counter and found it closed. Or even worse, like the three Nigerian fellows who hid behind the propeller of a ship that was about to leave. It was leaving from Apapa port in Nigeria. They took some chow and some dop with them for the long journey which they thought would be taking them to Spain. Spain. Well, unfortunately for them, the ship ended up in Ghana, where the authorities promptly found them and handed them over to the police. They will be sent back to Nigeria. Very depressing indeed. They're very depressing. And there's been lots of depressing stories coming out here also. Almost every day, new revelations of the coronavirus of corruption that's deeply infected this country. Coronavirus of corruption. Oh, by the way, there's some useless news. Do you know why they call it the coronavirus? Corona actually means when you put this virus under the microscope, it looks like it's got spikes coming out from the top. So it looks like a crown or the corona of the sun. There you are. This is an educational program, you see. So, now let me just tell you about what happened in Davos, Switzerland. There was a big economic summit and CNN's Richard Quest had a chat with the local, our local radio personality, Bruce Whitfield. He is the host of the Money Show. And Richard Quest didn't mince his words. He says, Brand South Africa, that's our team that was there, Brand South Africa has tried to put scarves around my neck, but it hasn't got the same profile as in previous years. There's no point in coming here to say, invest in me, if you don't have the policies worthy of it. We've discovered, he says, we've discovered just how awful state capture at state-owned enterprises was. You tell me how anybody who has come here for the past 5 or 10 years saying South Africa is going really well suddenly turns around and says, well, actually the entire economy was hijacked and we're not even sure we've dealt with it. How many people have gone to prison so far? That's what he asked Bruce Whitfield. And yesterday, Friday, senior ANC leader Supra Mapuma Pelo warned that the ANC will oppose any move to remove public protector Busisiwe Mkhwebane from office because, in his words, she was doing a great job. So in parliament, the ANC will use its majority to stop any such moves. The EFF will also oppose any such move against the public protector. There you are. There you are, folks. Another reason to be depressed. But hey, here in Durban, we are all very happy. We got a wonderful beachfront. And what an amazing promenade, that whole esplanade, the promenade we have here. The whole thing was improved at a cost of 300 million rands. And it opened just 2 months ago after the improvements, renovation and so on. And the it's been extended. So on Sunday, people are walking around there or jogging, or people are just eating, maybe families are there eating ice cream and taking a stroll with the children and so on. Yes, the wonderful brand new promenade along the Golden Mile. What a pride and joy for Durban, eh? But wait, hang on. It seems like it's not all cracked up to be such a great wonder after all. Not cracked up to be such a great wonder. An engineer was walking along and he found that it's already cracking and some parts are uneven. It's a danger to children, he said. IFP executive member Mdu Nkosi said that this was because people who were hired to do the job couldn't do it properly. It's all about the tenders. There you are. A glorious project came crashing down. Am I trying to make you depressed? Maybe. Who knows? Okay, let me change the subject. You know, I said it before and I'll say it again. I don't watch movies. Seriously, I don't watch movies. Haven't seen one for a very, very, very long time, even on TV. No, not because I am sort of some sort of goody two-shoes buzruk type. It's just that it's all make-believe. Here is this auntie on a dark and stormy night, running through a forest from a crazy guy with a big knife who is chasing her. And, of course, she's breathing heavily. She's terrified. She stumbles, and falls, and sprains her foot. She gets up. She tries to run, hopping along desperately. The mad O is searching for her. He's getting nearer and nearer, and you are at the edge of your seat. Hang on. Cut. Hey, Mamu. Running with that auntie. At least 20 or 30 other people, the director, the producer, a few camera guys, the clapper as it is called, and a whole lot of others. And the whole scene is filmed over maybe 2 or 3 days. People who are acting go back to the hotels or caravans and come back the next day to continue where they left off to make the whole thing as scary as possible, and you get bluffed as you munch your popcorn and your eyes are bulging out at the scary scene. The whole thing is so silly. Silly. So bottom line, sorry, I can't watch these actors. And that's what they are, acting. That auntie didn't sprain her leg and that Mad O is in real life a really wonderful guy who wouldn't even hurt a fly. So why am I telling you all this? You're wondering, eh? Wonder no more, dear listeners. The reason I'm telling you all this is that, yes, of course, a long time ago, I did watch some movies, and ones that really had some sort of a message, not mushy stuff. And one that stands out, the one particular one that stands out is a film called Schindler's List, way back in 1993. It was about the Holocaust, and more particularly about a man, Oskar Schindler, a German who saved 1,000 Jews from extermination by giving them jobs in his factory in Poland. The movie showed very graphically how Jews were starved and murdered in the concentration camps, hundreds of thousands. It was so realistic that I was hoping that in the dark cinema no one would notice the tears that were flowing out of my eyes. It was extremely touching, made me very, very sad indeed. It was man's inhumanity to man, a story of racial superiority, one powerful race treating another badly. Last week in Israel, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp, was commemorated. 40 dignitaries from around the world, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and German President Steinmeier, and Prince Charles also, were amongst others who attended the wreath-laying ceremony. And I couldn't help thinking that these people were solemnly commemorating the terrible treatment of one race by another, in a place where one race is treating another very badly. Hey? That's what I was thinking. That these people were solemnly commemorating the terrible treatment of one race by another in a place where one race is treating another race very badly. My thoughts were captured perfectly well by a journalist who I admire a great deal. Writing in the Haaretz newspaper, in Israel last week, journalist Gideon Levy was scathing about the event hosted by Israel. This is what he said. to be the guests of Israel without mentioning its crimes, to commemorate the Holocaust while ignoring its lessons, to visit Jerusalem without traveling to the Gaza ghetto on International Holocaust Remembrance Day, one can barely think of any greater hypocrisy. And he continues, when today they recite ad nauseam, never again, one should cast one's eyes honestly to the south and east, only a few kilometers away from the memorial hall of Yad Vashem, referring to Gaza as a concentration camp. He says there's no Holocaust there, only apartheid, no annihilation, but a systematic brutalization of a nation. Not Auschwitz, but Gaza. How can one ignore this on International Holocaust Remembrance Day? Wow, that really sums it up. Nothing more to add to that. And still on the subject of depression, Donald J. Trump, J., may I remind you again, stands for Jangli, gave a very important speech on Wednesday, and it made me run to the bathroom sink to bring up my supper. He announced his deal of the century that he was harping on about for the past 2 years, the deal of the century, his idea of a peace plan, a plan that will result in peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Of course, it was a peace plan. It gave tiny pieces of land to the Palestinians and everything else to the Israelis. It was the steal of the century, not the deal of the steal of the century. Palestinian land was being stolen. The whole speech was a big pile of steaming bull excrement, pure rubbish. But before we go any further, let me ask you this question, my dear listeners. I told you many times to go and look at a map of Palestine so that you understand what is Israel, what is the West Bank, what is the Gaza, and where is Jerusalem located. Put your hands up, all of you who did it. Right, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5! Out of all of you, only 5 looked at the map. You know, you people are pathetic. Hopeless. And you say that you are so concerned about Palestine when you don't even know where it is. Or in fact, there is. Is there such a place? Palestine. Yes, sir. All of you go right now, 100 times, I will check the map. Okay? And then go and stand in the corner until I tell you to come out. And I don't want to hear you saying that your legs are paining, okay? You can see I got grandchildren in the house. Right. So let me give you a 1 minute history lesson on the so-called Palestine-Israeli conflict. All right. Up to 1900, there was this place called Palestine. There were 54,000 Jews living there and 600,000 Palestinians. And they were living in peace. For hundreds of years, centuries, living in peace. Palestinians at that time owned over 90%, maybe over 95% of the land. Then the British came in and took over and allowed Jews from Europe to pour into Palestine. And of course, fighting broke out and steadily got worse. The Jewish groups, let's call them the Zionists, they were very well trained and very well armed. Britain in 1947 said it was pulling out, couldn't stand the heat because it was being attacked. Bombs were put all over the place against the British. So Britain said, look, within a year it's going to pull out. In 1948, the Zionist forces spread out all over Palestine and 750,000 Palestinians left their homes and they fled mainly to surrounding countries. Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, and so on. Zionists destroyed over 500 Palestinian villages and captured 78% of the land. Did you get that, 78% of the land and called it Israel. Arab forces from surrounding countries came in last minute and they managed to capture a small part. Egypt captured Gaza. and another known as the West Bank, and half of Jerusalem was captured by Jordan. And of course, you know that Al-Aqsa is located in East Jerusalem. These three parts made up the balance, that is 22%. Gaza, West Bank, and half of Jerusalem. Are you still with me? I told you all this before, but you forgot, didn't you? Right. Hey, stop talking there in the back, okay, and pay attention. Then in 1967, in the Six-Day War, Israel captured this 22%. In other words, got the whole thing. Well, Yasser Arafat and his fighters, they tried very hard attacking Israel from Jordan and then from Beirut, and then finally they ended up in Tunisia, where they got fat and lazy. Then Israel and Western countries told Arafat, stop fighting, come back, and let's talk about giving you your own state on this 22%. An agreement was signed in 1993 in the United States. It was known as the peace process, the Oslo Accords. A two-state solution, that's what they said. We're going to give the Palestinians a state, and we're going to negotiate about all this, about Jerusalem, half of Jerusalem being part of the, or be the capital of the new state, which will be in the West Bank and Gaza. And we're also going to negotiate about refugees from the surrounding countries coming back, thousands and thousands of them who were living there since 1948. And Arafat and his merry men came back, and they were given seven little towns to rule over. Israel, in the meantime, started building massive settlements, huge housing estates all over the West Bank. Today, 600,000 Israelis live in these settlements in the West Bank, spread all over the West Bank. So land was confiscated in the West Bank. So what did the Palestinians get up to now, up to today? Zero. Zero. Zilch. Nothing. The whole peace deal, as I said right from the start, was a scam, a bluff. Israel was never serious about giving the Palestinians their own state. And now, Donald Trump's new deal, the deal of the century, the deal of the century which he announced. Well, this deal canceled the old one, the so-called peace deal signed in 1993. In the deal, Israel gets the whole of Jerusalem as its capital. It gets all the settlements in the West Bank. They will all become part of Israel. The Jordan Valley, which is in the West Bank, a very fertile piece of ground along the Jordan River, which is the border between Israel and Jordan. That whole thing becomes part of Israel. Add all that up and Israel gets about half of the West Bank. That's half of the 22%. And the little bits of land, well, perhaps not 22%, but anyway, half of the West Bank and the little bits of land like Botswana, the Bantustan, is left to the Palestinians. You remember Botswana, little bits of land here and there all over? And that was called an independent state, a Bantustan. So little bits of land is left to the Palestinians for the so-called state. And yes, one more thing, all those thousands of Palestinians, the refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria and Egypt, who fled in 1948 and again in the Six-Day War in 1967, they will not be allowed back into Palestine. Khalas, it's over. Jungli's deal of the century. Now you know why I ran to the bathroom. And there he was, President Padla, standing next to Netanyahu in the White House and making this big announcement. Incredible, isn't it? Incredible. A deal for peace between Israel, the Israelis and the Palestinians. And no Palestinians were present. Just let that sink in for a minute. A deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and no Palestinians were present or had any input into this deal. You don't know whether to laugh or cry. Of course, Netanyahu was beaming, standing next to Trump. And also, after every sentence, every pronouncement that Donald Trump made, all the Zionists and the pro-Israeli supporters who were in the room with Pagla stood up and applauded every statement that he made. What a joke. A sick joke. That's what it is. A sick joke. Pagla actually made it sound like a brilliant plan. But you know what? It was just a big lie. Just a big lie. That's what it was. And then I thought, what if Donald J. Trump actually stood up and spoke the truth? That would be something, wouldn't it? And then I started thinking and thinking what that would sound like if Donald Trump was speaking the truth, if he spoke the truth. And you know what? The more I thought about it, the more it amused me to think what he would say. So I thought, well, I'll share that with you. The speech that Donald Trump should have made. Are you ready for that speech? Okay. Let's do that after the break, okay? After the break. The speech that Donald Trump should have made. Yes, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. Broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. And I told you that after I heard Donald Trump's speech, I was wondering what would have happened if he spoke the truth. That would be something, right? And then, as I said, I was thinking, what would that sound like if Donald Trump actually spoke the truth in that big announcement that he made on Wednesday about the deal of the century? And it amused me to think what he would say. So I thought I'll share that with you. Are you ready for the speech that Donald Trump should have made? Right. Here goes.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's really wonderful to see this room full of people, very excited. All you pro-Israeli supporters, and especially the large group of extreme right-wing settlers from the West Bank who came from very far away, especially to hear my wonderful announcement, my deal of the century, that the world has been waiting so long to hear. But let me take you back a little bit. A few months ago, my dear friend Benjamin Netanyahu, let me call him Bibi, came to visit me at the White House. He looked very depressed, very depressed. I said, "What's the matter, Bibi? What's on your mind?" And he answered, "Donald, I got problems, and you got problems. You are facing the impeachment trials, and you will be facing elections at the end of the year. I am facing fraud and corruption charges, and elections in Israel will be taking place in 6 weeks' time. So we both got problems. So we both got to work together. I can help you, and you can help me." So I said, "Okay, Bibi, you're right. We both got problems. So what's your plan?" And Bibi said, "Look, you give me what I want, and I will make sure that all the supporters of Israel in the United States make sure you get elected as president again. And what you give me will make my people very happy, and I'll become prime minister once again, prime minister of Israel. How does that sound, Donald?" Well, I must confess, I was happy with this plan, because I really enjoyed being the president of the United States, the toughest man in the whole world. It's really great fun. So I said, "Bibi, what do you want?" And Bibi said, "Give me Jerusalem, the whole thing." I said, "Okay, you got it." He said, "Give me all the settlements." I said, "Okay, buddy, you got it." He said, give me Jordan Valley. You got it, baby. He said, I want Hamas disarmed. I said, no problem. He said, no Palestinian refugees must come back. I said, take it as done, buddy. He said, Israel must be recognized as a Jewish state. I said, okie dokie, pal, you got it. And that is how my deal of the century came about. But let me tell you, good people, I know nothing about what's happening out there. Someone told me that the Muslims pray in Jerusalem in a mosque called Al-Aqwa. Al-Aqwa, strange name to me, sounds like a swimming pool. I know nothing about what's happening there. So I gave Bibi's request to a team to work it all out. The team was headed by my son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's a smart boy. He's a smart boy. He's Jewish. And he's married to my wonderful daughter, Ivanka, who converted to Judaism. Yes, Jared was leading the pack. And he's such a close friend of Netanyahu, really close. And others who were involved included was our ambassador to Israel, my good friend David Friedman, who said that God had sent Donald Trump to occupy the White House and support Israel. He's a great guy, David. Yes, he is Jewish and a first-class Zionist. And my Secretary of State, that's my Foreign Minister Mike Pompeo, he's a first-class Christian evangelist. He believes that all the land belongs to Israel. So he's a Christian Zionist, a great supporter of Israel. And my Vice President, Mike Pence, is a great guy. Another Christian Zionist, he believes that it's God's will that Jews should have all the Holy Land. And so many more Zionists were involved in putting the deal together. But I must tell you folks, it was a really tough job. We give everything to the Israelis and almost zero to the Palestinians. But we have to make it look like a very fair deal. Tough job, tough job. How do you make a big lie sound like the truth? How do you make a big lie sound like the truth? Tough job. But they put it together, my deal of the century. And so here it is. I give the whole of Jerusalem to Israel as its undivided capital. But I must sound as if I am fair. So I give the Palestinians their capital in Jerusalem also. Well, not quite inside Jerusalem, on the border of Jerusalem, in a village called Abu Dis. It's a small place, 20,000 people, and cut off from Jerusalem by that 8-meter-high wall, that long wall Israel built, and it is surrounded by Israeli settlements. So that's the capital of the Palestinians, Abu Dis. All the settlements in the West Bank go to Israel, and also the Jordan Valley in the West Bank, which means that the Palestinians will have bits and pieces of land left for their state. So how can bits and pieces be called a complete state if they are not connected? If they're not connected. Jared is brilliant. He is a genius. He said that bridges and tunnels will link these parts, these small parts to each other and also to Gaza. So voila, you will have a complete connected state, a Palestinian state, the two-state solution. and Palestinian refugees are not allowed to return. So what's the big deal, eh? They've been out since 1948, and Hamas has to be disarmed. Well, that's also not a big deal, because they are already in the big Gaza prison. Yes, of course, they will fire one or two hopeless rockets, and Israel will send its fighter jets and smash a few buildings and kill some people, and it's over. It's been happening many times. It's happened many times. Of course, this plan is stupid. It's absolutely stupid. I know that. It's not about peace. It's about giving Bibi and the right wing in Israel everything they want. And it may get Netanyahu re-elected. Let's see what happens, and let's see what happens. And this is good for me, because the pro-Israeli group here in the United States will be happy. Especially my friend Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire, who calls me all the time to give Israel what it wants. Always telling me to give Israel what it wants. And he gives me what I want. Millions of dollars for my election campaign. And the Christian evangelicals who believe that it's God's will that the Holy Land, all of it belongs to the Jews, a really great bunch of guys. About 70 million of them here in the United States, and most of them voted for me to be president. And now they'll be happy and will vote for me again. And that's the single most important thing for me, to be president again, not what's happening to the Palestinians. I don't really care about that. That's not my business. As long as I get the votes, that's what matters. Even with this stupid lopsided deal, no problem. Of course, I know it's stupid, and I know that the Palestinians will be upset. They will demonstrate in Gaza and West Bank, and Israel will respond with tear gas and rubber bullets. It's been happening for a long time, and then the dust will settle, and everything will be back to normal. And Mahmoud Abbas will huff and puff and make all kinds of threats. But in the end, he and his big boys in his toy parliament, they need their salaries, his cabinet, members of parliament, his cabinet and his police force, security people. They've done a great job for Israel's security. And of course, all of them need their money, their salaries, so they will continue as a toy government, a joke. That's what it is. It's a joke. They will continue in control of 7 or 8 little towns. And there's lots of lovely corruption in the Palestinian Authority to keep them from abandoning the silly government that they set up with Israel. The Palestinian Authority. What a joke. So, what about the Arab world? What will they do? And the answer is nothing. We got the UAE and Oman and Bahrain right here in the room to support my plan. My good friend, big boy Salman, called me and said he supports the plan. Salman, Mohammed Salman, he's the big shot from Saudi Arabia. He phoned me and he said he supports the plan, but he just couldn't make it here today. All of these dictators are in the pockets of the United States, so no problem. Boris Johnson of Britain says it's a good thing. It's a good plan. He's a great guy. Europe is quiet because they need our trade, as does the rest of the world. So, no big noise from there. And that's it. My deal of the century. A done deal. But I have to make it sound fair to the Palestinians. Giving small pieces of disjointed land sounds very bad. So, Jared, He's a genius. He said, okay, let's promise them that we will give the Palestinians $50 billion, $50 billion, so they can develop themselves on their new state. We won't say when they'll get the money, and if we do give them, if we do give them some of it, we'll get it from the rich Arab countries to put it up. Saudi Arabia already agreed. They can't refuse to give it up. They do what we say. Otherwise, we will work to get them, to get these dictators out like we did Saddam Hussein. So, they are really scared of us. And so we put it to the Palestinians, take the deal. Take the deal. Take the money. Or you will suffer even more than you are now. There's a wonderful name for this. It's called blackmail. And there's nothing they can do about it. They are all alone. Nobody cares about them to do anything for them. I will get re-elected. Bibi will get re-elected. And everyone will live happily thereafter. Thank you and have a great day. So, there you are, folks. My terrible imitation of Donald Jungly Trump speaking the truth. But, of course, he can't do that. Speak the truth. Because he will have to admit that it's the fraud of the century. So, where to from here, eh? Where to from here? Well, I said it before and I'll say it again. There's a silver lining to this cloud. Since 1993, when the so-called peace deal was signed between Israel and the Palestinians were given a government in some towns, controlled some towns, as I said, a parliament which had MPs. So, since then, 1993, Israel said that Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are controlling themselves. And Israel has got nothing to do with them. They've got their own government. They are controlling themselves. So, now, if, and I say if, Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank and Hamas in Gaza say, okay, right, we are dissolving our government. We are abandoning it completely, this whole idea of us having this toy government. They're giving it up. Then all the Palestinians in the West Bank, especially in the West Bank, will be directly under the control of Israel. Israel will have to take over. And if Israel deals with them under different laws and rules, then this will clearly be what? What's the word? Apartheid. Racial discrimination. Two sets of rules. And that would give greater leverage, greater weapon in the hands of those who oppose Israel on the international front, the international stage. You can accuse Israel of practicing apartheid, a dirty word that. Effectively, you will have one state and two peoples, and that has always been a recurring nightmare for Israel, that the Palestinians, that the Palestine Authority will one day throw in the towel and say, okay, you now take responsibility for us, all of us. You take responsibility for us. So that's my two cents, seeking a way forward of this very difficult problem, terrible problem. But let's give a human face to this whole thing in time that I've got left. There is a journalist and activist by the name of Ahmad Abu Atima. He is based in the Gaza. And his article is headlined, Trapped and Voiceless, The Palestinians Depicted in Trump's Plan. That's the headline.
And the subheading is, the world does not hear our stories or see our reality. Why would they stand in solidarity with us? And this is what he says. Donald Trump's Middle East plan has fully adopted the Israeli agenda and ignores the fundamental problem that has continued for more than 70 years. Palestinians are not striving to improve the conditions of their imprisonment. We want the return of our refugees and the end of the occupation. As it is, Palestinians are trapped with very little freedom of movement and no voice to tell our side of the story. That is not going to change with this so-called deal, especially when the international community turns a blind eye to the reality on the ground for ordinary people. I feel the isolation that Palestinians are subjected to most painfully when I travel. What I love most about traveling is the freedom of movement, being able to get in a car, listen to music, and just set off. But more than 70 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights stipulated the right to freedom of movement, this is not something most Palestinians can contemplate. People around the world who may not even know they have this defined right exercise it on a daily basis. But for those living in the Palestinian territories, essentially a detention camp surrounded by fences, walls, and military towers, to try is to risk your life. In Gaza and the West Bank, a person's ability to travel is conditional upon obtaining a permit from the Israeli government and then going on a waiting list administered by Gaza's Ministry of the Interior. As a result, the vast majority of Gazans have not left the Gaza Strip since the Israeli blockade began in 2007. The decision to travel is usually made only in cases of extreme need, such as for urgent medical treatment. A few months ago, I received an invitation from NOVACT, the International Institute for Nonviolent Action, which is based in Spain, to take part in a speaking tour in conjunction with a number of other civil organizations about the situation in Gaza. I was asked to give talks in Belgium, Germany, Spain, and the Czech Republic, Italy, Finland, the Netherlands, France, and Slovenia. This invitation was the reason I was granted a Schengen visa, and as soon as I got it, I registered my name on the travel waiting list in Gaza. I waited 2 months. The conversations I had with my European colleagues during this time perfectly summed up the difference in our experiences and expectations. They needed to schedule my activities. They would ask, on what day? I would reply, I cannot say. It is not in my control. They would respond, okay, so in which week? I would tell them, I don't know that either. Plans can only be made when I have actually left Gaza. So, in which month will that be? And I answer, maybe in December, maybe January. When I'm able to travel, I will let you know. When I eventually got permission to travel, the experience was one of joy tinged with sorrow that others from my country could not enjoy the simple rights. On the road from Germany to the Czech Republic, and later from the Czech Republic to Austria, I saw no borders to tell me that I was entering a new country. The only thing that informed me was the welcome message I received from my telecom provider on my mobile phone. I could pass through European airports without registration, waiting lists, or lengthy interrogations. I could disembark from a plane and head to the exit gate without being stopped by a security officer. It was a shock. Dozens of activists I met in Europe told me that they had visited Palestine. The thought that they had roamed our cities, learned about our culture, tasted our food, and felt the warmth of our sun always made me feel good. Did you visit Gaza? I would ask them.
No, only the West Bank, they would invariably reply. Israel would not give us permission to visit Gaza. Not only are Gazans locked in, but others are locked out. And this isolation is killing us and our story. When people do not know us, when they do not see our reality, the chances of them standing in solidarity with us are diminished. During my tour of Europe, I saw firsthand what it means when Palestinians in Gaza cannot tell their story. I was repeatedly asked by people who knew nothing of the long history of Jews being an important part of the fabric of Arab society, why Arabs were so hostile to Jews. I was probed about the role of Hamas in the Great March of Return, peaceful Friday protest by Palestinians, and whether this was the reason the Israeli army had used excessive force against the demonstrators. I replied that according to the reports, 213 Palestinians had been killed since the demonstrations began in March 2018, and more than 36,000 injured, many of whom have been left with permanent disabilities. In contrast, no Israelis had died. I was asked why we did not just make peace with the Israelis. But peace is not something the victims of occupation, displacement and oppression can initiate, I replied. Now, as Trump's new Middle East plan silences the voice of Palestinians, our stories, our realities, more than ever, Europe has a decision to make. The EU has for many years expressed its so-called deep concerns over Israel's targeted killings and illegal settlements, but pro-Palestinian activists increasingly face censure and restrictions in European cities. Last May, Germany passed a symbolic resolution designating the boycott, divestment, sanctions, that's the BDS movement, as anti-Semitic, even though the movement's demands are based on international law and the methods it uses are peaceful. In December, the French Parliament passed a resolution that labeled anti-Zionism a form of anti-Semitism. Europe today faces a real test. Will it value the principles of freedom of opinion, expression and movement and the international law that underpins these, or will it help in the continued silencing and stifling of Palestinians? In Europe and the international community, if Europe and the international community get behind Trump's Middle East plan, a plan in which the Palestinians have no say, the answer will be clear. There you are. That was the views of Ahmed Abu Atema, who is a Palestinian journalist and a peace activist. That's where we're going to leave it. And now, from the graveyard of the light of at the end of the tunnel. Right. Some of our chaps were at Dubai airport waiting to take flight, to take the flight home. And they had to wait for 6 hours. And they were always reclining on the chairs there, tired. And one brother, let me call him Abu Bakr, maybe short for AB, was sitting next to a group of Americans. And one American started talking to brother Abu Bakr, and asked him what was his area of interest. And he answered, Middle East politics. And the American said, okay, let's see what you know about the Middle East, about Middle East politics. But brother Abu Bakr said, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm really tired. I just want to get some sleep. And then he lay down on the seat. But the American persisted. Come on, let me ask you a question. And then you can ask me one. And Abu Bakr said, no, man, you know, let's just leave it. Hey, I'm very tired. And the American said, okay, let me make it more interesting. If I fail to answer your question, I'll give you $10. If I fail to answer your question, I'll give you $10. And if you fail, you give me $10. But Abu Bakr remained unmoved.
Said he was tired. The American persisted. Okay, let's do it this way. You ask me a question. The American said, you ask me a question. If I don't answer, I'll give you $100. And if I ask you a question and you can't answer, you give me $10 only. Well, Abu Bakr raised his head. He thought for a moment and then he asked the question to the American. Right, okay. Here's the question. When the Oslo Accords were signed on the lawns of the White House, Yasser Arafat leaned over to Bill Clinton and whispered something into his ear. What was it? Well, the American was stunned. He thought for a while. He pulled out his laptop. He did a Google search. He went over to his friends and he discussed it with them. He phoned home to some experts that he knew. Then after 20 minutes, he came back to Abu Bakr. He woke him up and said, okay, I give up. Here's your $100. Abu Bakr took the $100. The American asked, so tell me, what is the answer to the question? And without a word, Abu Bakr took out $10 and gave it to him and turned back on his seat and went to sleep. I wonder who's this Abu Bakr character. This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't forget, the program continues on Radio Al Ansar, inshallah, after the 12 o'clock news. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.